The Book Nook on WYSO is made possible by five local library systems in Southwest Ohio: the Greene County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Clark County Public Library, the Dayton Metro Library, and the Wright Memorial Public Library.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I'd like to welcome to the program today Ann Fadiman. Hello, Ann.
Hello, Vic. So pleased to be with you today.
And I was so excited when I received a copy of your book. I got an advanced copy of your new one, The Wine Lover's Daughter, a memoir. And when I saw it, I said, this is the book I have been waiting for, because I remember as a little boy seeing your dad on television and hearing him on the radio and thinking, this guy's the smartest guy in the world. Your dad was Clifton Fadiman.
Well, thank you so much. Aside from my publisher, you may be the only person in the entire United States who was actually waiting for this book, but I am so delighted that you were. It's interesting that the first thing you said is how smart my father was. I don't know whether you've read Michael Chabon's The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay, but one of the two main characters, Sammy, is growing up in Brooklyn in the late 30s, says that he dreams of being a famous doctor or maybe a great writer or maybe just a famous smart person like Clifton Fadiman. And I loved that in those days you could aspire to be a famous smart person. These days, I suppose the Kardashians are famous for being famous, but do we admire anyone who's famous for simply being smart?
The Kardashians, I'm not familiar with them. My guest is Ann Fadiman. You wrote this book about your father, Clifton. It's really a loving tribute. What made you decide to do it?
Well, my father, I guess when I first got the idea, my father had been dead for about a decade. That's a good amount of time to feel that you're able to sort things anew and look at them afresh. My father was really interesting. I'm his literary executor, so I had all of his letters and about 1,000 of his books and a whole bunch of tapes I had made in 1984 when he was 80 years old. So I thought it might be nice if I could do something about them. But mainly I'd been pondering a letter that I'd come across that he'd written to a friend of his when he was in his 70s. And in that letter he said, in our culture, it's difficult, if not impossible, for children ever really to get to know their parents. And I thought, I really want to give it a try. Let's see how far I can get.
And we probably have two or three people out there, I hate to admit this, who are scratching their heads and going, Clifton Fadiman, never heard of him. Who was he?
Sure. I would imagine about 99% of the people listening will accept listeners who are over the age of 80. My father was primarily known as an essayist and a critic, but in his early days, well, for example, at age 28, he was the editor-in-chief of Simon & Schuster. At the age of 29, the book reviewer for The New Yorker, and at the age of 34, the MC of Information Please, which was a radio show, a quiz show from the glory days of radio, to which at its height more than a tenth of the U.S. population used to tune in every Tuesday night between 8:30 and 9.
Go on. He did so much more.
Well, he was an anthologist. He did a great deal of editing. For many decades, he was on the board of judges of the Book of the Month Club. He represented that marvelous and now completely obsolete self-improvement movement that peaked during the two world wars, the same impulse during that era that made people want to buy encyclopedias from door-to-door salesmen, my father fit into perfectly, starting with teaching night classes on the great books soon after he got out of college in the 1920s, and then through the Book of the Month Club and through giving intermission talks at the Boston Symphony. He fed right into the American middle-brow desire for intellectual self-improvement. His best-known book was probably his collection of essays on 100 great books you should read before you die. It was called The Lifetime Reading Plan. And just to show how antique his worldview would seem now, of those 100 great books, and 97 were by men, 99 were by white men, and 100 were by Western writers. Sorry, 99 were by white writers, and 100 were by Western writers.
Wow, even Harold Bloom could have done a little better than that.
Yes, of course, my father did end up doing better than that, because at the very end of his life, actually in his 90s, he hired a collaborator who was a specialist in Asian literature, in general in world literature, to revise it with him. And the new edition, which is still in print, contains a number of non-Western books, many more books by writers who were neither white nor male. So his view really broadened in his old age. Mm-hmm. During the years when most people narrow, the old people that you know, people who've lived past 90, aren't they mostly stuck in their ways and getting more and more stuck and complaining more and more about how the world is changing every year? It's really extraordinary that in literature and in many other areas of his life, he just got more and more open-minded with every passing year.
Well, I'm fortunate to know some people that are more like your dad. They get more open-minded and progressive as they get older, but we won't go down that particular alleyway. Mm. My guest is Anne Fadiman. Her book is The Wine Lover's Daughter. And it's fascinating to read about how your father reinvented himself. He came from very humble beginnings, didn't he?
Yes. He was always very careful to say that his family was not lower class. He talked about them as being members of the very lowest rung of the lower middle class, which is a sort of delicate parsing that only someone who was incredibly class conscious would have made. His parents were Jewish immigrants from Russia. His father's family came from a small village outside Minsk. His mother came from Ukraine. And he was raised in Brooklyn long before it was fashionable. He was born in 1904, before there was electricity, when the streets of Brooklyn were mostly dirt and the things were delivered in horse-drawn wagons, and everybody in his neighborhood spoke another language or highly accented English. He shared a bed with his two brothers. But like many sons of immigrants at the beginning of the 20th century, managed to pull himself up by his bootstraps, went to a good public school, ended up at Columbia. So yes, like many members of his generation, he essentially refashioned himself so that he wouldn't sound like his parents, which is was useful for all of them, but also kind of poignant because it involved a cutting off of roots that I think perhaps would have grounded that entire generation a little bit more solidly if they'd felt they could keep them.
I really enjoyed some of the visual images that you give us of him, and one that I recall fondly is the image of him navigating the busy streets of Brooklyn as a boy, reading a book with his head buried in a book, and just was so adept at able to walk around like that.
Yes. He would get the maximum number of books every week from the library, and it was so important to to him not to miss a minute of reading that one of the few physical activities he was ever really good at was ambulatory reading. When he was a boy, he could step on and off curbs and go around cars all without taking his eyes off the page. It's sort of like driving while texting these days or using a cell phone. Probably ambulatory reading should probably be illegal because it's so dangerous. But in any case, he seems to have survived. And the point was that books were for him a way out of Brooklyn, a way to get out of his relatively narrow life and see that there was this extraordinary world of words and magic and culture. All he had to do was go to the library.
The book is The Wine Lover's Daughter, a memoir. Ann Fadiman wrote it. She joins us on the program today. And on the cover, you've got a picture of you embracing your dad. And around you, the frame of the picture is in the shape of a wine bottle. And your father was an aspiring guy. He aspired to great things. And one of the things along his route of aspiration was after he became a wine lover. This really opened him up to the world, didn't it?
It did. I had thought for many years I wanted to write something about my father, but I think I would have floundered as well as written a 1,000-page book instead of a relatively modestly sized book if I had just tried to write a general memoir, everything about my father. Having a microcosmic way into a subject, I think, always helps you focus. The two things my father loved most in the world were books and wine. And since I love books myself, I didn't feel that I would be able to understand him anew if I simply explored an area of overlapping interest. But I don't particularly like wine, and I thought, gosh, you can really understand a person by understanding what he loves. So I resolved to make wine a kind of central core of the book. I would say that it occupies less than half the book. The book is mainly a family memoir, but I keep coming back to wine as an important theme because it was a symbol of everything he aspired to, just as you say. And wine also, I think, represented to him the quality to have himself. Wine was elegant. Wine was complex. Wine, because, of course, to him, wine meant European wine. He first started drinking wine during and then right after Prohibition, so there were no American wines. Great French wine was a connection to the broad sweep of Western civilization, which he loved so much as a reader and with which he wanted to connect. So wine was something he genuinely loved, and gosh, watching him take a sip of wine, his look would be absolutely ecstatic. But a complicated look. There were so many different feelings there. Wine wasn't like milk. You could just swallow it down, only one flavor. To have wine in one's mouth, in his view, was to have entire worlds of both flavor and associations. So I thought if I could look at his life through the arc of his relationship with wine and what it meant to him, that would provide just an interesting narrative spine to the book and help me understand some things about him that I hadn't previously known.
Your father wrote that wine is not dead matter like a motor car, but a live thing. And you spent all these times with him drinking wine. Tell us about the discovery of wine that you look back on when he went to Europe and really discovered it for the first time, and it changed his life, didn't it?
Totally changed his life. So when he was in college, it was the height of Prohibition, and he certainly had tasted liquor, but not wine. Wine was generally not served in speakeasies. People wanted to get drunk, and also speakeasies benefited by being able to store and then serve liquor that was maximally alcoholic. So he tasted plenty of alcohol, but he hadn't ever tasted wine. And then when he was 23 years old, in 1927, he retrieved an errant first wife who had wandered off with, as he told it, a count or a baron. And I said, well, which was it? And he said, oh, I don't know, which one is better? In any case, she ran off with some sort of Italian patrician, and he went to Paris, and he successfully retrieved the first wife. And to celebrate, they went to lunch at a French department store, which doesn't sound incredibly romantic, but it was. There, on a hot summer day, he tasted his first sip of wine. It was a chilled bottle of white Grave, not expensive, but he felt as if he had finally met something that he'd known all his life but never encountered. And although the first marriage didn't last, the love affair with wine lasted his entire life.
You are listening to 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world. And it's my pleasure to have Anne Fadiman on the program today. Her book, The Wine Lover's Daughter, a memoir, came out recently. And I was just looking today as we are recording this, the NPR Book Concierge year-end book reviews was issued, and I see your book's on the list.
Oh, that's great. I didn't know that. Thanks for telling me.
Yeah, there it is.
I love the notion of a book concierge. I could use my own personal book concierge. I wish I had one downstairs right now.
Well, I've wanted you to appear as a guest on the program for at least 10 years because I love your book, The Spirit Catches You and You Fall Down, which won the National Book Critics Circle Award. A very different book, however.
Yes, that was my first book, and that was a work of reportage. It was a nonfiction book about a Hmong family from Laos, a family of refugees, and the cultural impasse they had with their American doctors in California over the care of their young daughter who had epilepsy. So it was a book about cross-cultural miscommunication. Very different from this. I suppose with that book, you could say I was following in the footsteps of my mother, who had been a reporter, rather than those of my father, who was an essayist. Of course, neither of them wrote a memoir, so with The Wine Lover's Daughter, perhaps that was new ground in which I wasn't following in anybody's footsteps. And that was a very important landmark for me, not just in my own career as a writer, but in showing me that my own, over-cerebrating background, the notion that the Fadimans had that any problem could be solved rationally if you were just smart enough, that pretty much exploded that notion for me. The problems I described in that book could not be solved by being smart, and it made me realize that there were many different kinds of intelligence, and that emotional intelligence and intuition and the ability to empathize with other people were often the most important.
After reading The Wine Lover's Daughter, I had my curiosity piqued, and I went and tracked down a copy of Thunder Out of China, which was co-written by your mother. I think it's a tremendous book.
So much. It's almost unbelievable that you went and tracked that down. So Thunder Out of China, written in the 1940s by my mother and Theodore H. White, is actually still in print. It's had a variety of editions over the years. My mother, Annalee Whitmore Jacoby Fadiman, was the only woman war correspondent in China during the Second World War. And so she was a really courageous person, who was sort of not afraid of physical danger and underwent a great deal while she was a war correspondent, really different from my father. Her second husband, her first husband, was killed in the war. My father was a really indoorsy guy who would have been happy to spend his entire life reading in the library. And that was a book about China's role in the Second World War that actually caused her and her co-author quite a few problems because it was severely critical of our foreign policy during that time.
I have fond memories of watching the old TV quiz shows and seeing people like Dorothy Kilgallen and Peggy mm-hmm. Cass and Orson Bean and mm-hmm. and Bennett Cerf. Bennett Cerf was a key figure in your dad's career, wasn't he?
Bennett Cerf was indeed a really key figure in my father's life. He was the chairman of Random House when my father was in need of some money so that he could go to Paris and retrieve his first wife. And one of my father's Columbia professors asked Cerf whether there was any available work at Random House for this marvelous former student of his. He was immediately assigned the translation of two books by Nietzsche. And on the way to France, he translated them while sitting in the ship's bar, nursing a glass of beer. He still had never tasted wine at that point. One of them is actually still in print, and I was giving a reading in a bookstore just last week, and one of the members of the audience showed me that in that very bookstore was one of those very volumes of Nietzsche, still in print, about, I don't know, 90 years later. So if it hadn't been for Bennett Cerf, who knows what would have happened to my father? Bennett Cerf gave him his start, and later on they became good friends.
Anne Fadiman joins us. Her book is The Wine Lover's Daughter, a memoir. Your dad became quite a wine collector, didn't he?
Yes, he did. He started in 1935, so that was just 2 years after the end of Prohibition. So let's imagine what being a wine collector would have meant right after the end of Prohibition. Of course, it would have meant no American wines. There had been a nascent wine industry before Prohibition, mostly in upper New York State, but of course that had been completely obliterated during the years of Prohibition. So it meant collecting European wines, mostly French wines. At that time, my father was the editor-in-chief of Simon & Schuster, and he had published a book that was designed to introduce Americans to wine, and the author of that book became a very close friend of my father's and taught him a lot about wine. He was also a wine importer, and that author really got pretty rich when my father started collecting because I discovered, I had never known this before, but found documents that showed me that on his very first day as a collector in the fall of 1935, my father bought more than 900 bottles of wine. Oh my gosh, the prices, just enough to make you laugh or maybe weep. My father wrote down exactly how much everything cost, and so things like Chateau Lafite Rothschild, $1.75 a bottle, Chambertin, $1.65 a bottle, and so on. Even if you factor in inflation, the prices were just extraordinarily low. A regular person could buy one of the greatest wines in the world, and now you have to be a multimillionaire.
And his friend Sam Aaron set him up and got him some great wine. And your father lived long enough to enjoy most of it, didn't he?
Yes. Sam Aaron wasn't the original writer of the book that my father published. That was Frank Schoonmaker. Sam Aaron was a wine merchant that my father met a little bit later who ran the most famous wine store in New York City, Shari Lehman. And the two of them became extremely close friends and wrote a wine book together called The Joys of Wine, a huge, lavishly illustrated anthology that included some essays on wine by my father. One reviewer said, it's not just a coffee table book. It's a coffee table.
And near the end of the book, you address your concern that for some reason his passion for wine apparently skipped a generation in you, at least. Didn't you have your taste buds analyzed to try to figure out?
I did. It was absolutely fascinating. I didn't consider it a tragedy, but I'd always been mildly melancholy about the fact that this thing that my father clearly derived so much pleasure from, and not just sensory pleasure, but aesthetic pleasure from, in other words, wine, had never given me much pleasure. I don't hate wine, but I don't appreciate it. And it's always tasted too strong to me, the way undiluted whiskey might taste to some people. Mm. So I did eventually go see a couple of taste scientists, and I had some taste tests and some genetic tests that indeed revealed that I have a palate very different from that of my father, that I have just plain old biological reasons for being especially sensitive to bitter and sour tastes. And that limits my wine palate and makes wine taste too strong. So finding this out, and it was really pretty cut and dried when I did find it out, it was a relief in a way because it got me off the hook. It wasn't a matter of an aesthetic failing on my part, but it also made me kind of sad because it also meant that there was no hope. I was never going to love wine. That didn't mean I couldn't still be interested in the idea of wine and the role it played in my father's life, and, of course, that's what so much of this book is about.
Mm. I see that you are the writer in residence at Yale.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes me wonder, we've had Professor Harold Bloom on the show a couple times.
Uh-huh.
It's been a long time. Is he still active? We had him on for Shakespeare, The Invention of the Human. And
mm-hmm.
He's unique. There's nobody like him. And he's really like a Renaissance man from the old tradition. He's just...
Yes, I would agree. There is no one like him. And he completely inspires his students. He has totally different rules for his class from anybody else. Students don't have to turn in their final papers before the end of the semester. He doesn't like them to write them when they're too jammed up with other commitments.
Uh-huh.
So he grades them, giving everybody an A without reading their final papers. But it's so hard to get into his classes, and he's so inspiring that probably people deserve those A's because they're so engaged. Mm-hmm. He's just his own universe at Yale.
You've been listening to the Book Nook on WYSO. My guest has been Ann Fadiman. Her memoir is The Wine Lover's Daughter. And I just want to thank you for a beautiful book. You are just a splendid writer.
Oh, thank you so much, Vic.
For the Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis.